is Tidings and I'm Hazel Kahn. The story I'm bringing you today has heightened meaning after the floods we're experiencing as climate changes our planet. Images of floods have become part of global consciousness, as have the disastrous numbers expressed in dollars and geography, magnified by heartrending personal stories of this individual, that family, or those businesses, and new stories of unresponsive bureaucracies and the sluggish pace of remedy. There seem to be no grand stories, which is why I'm bringing you a surprising story from a country that usually evokes the brutal side of humanity. Here is a grand story from Pakistan of a new generation envisioning, rebuilding, and bringing new life out of what was destroyed. My guest is Heather Ibrahim, a young Pakistani architect educated in the United States, who returned to his country in 2007, 3 years before the first of the two floods that ravaged large agricultural areas of the southern Punjab along the Indus River. In the vacuum created by an unresponsive government, Heather and his colleagues seized the opportunity to realize a new sense of themselves as Pakistanis, architects, and nation builders. Resettling the Indus contains a vision that extends beyond simply rebuilding the 1.2 million homes destroyed in these floods. It draws inspiration from 5,000 years ago, from the great Bronze Age Indus civilization, notable for producing bricks, drainage systems, and multi-storied houses. Translating this history into sustainability lies at the heart of RTI's philosophy, an improbable goal only 2 years ago for a people so traumatized by the loss of homes, families, and livelihood. The RTI model is based on community-centered enterprises that use local materials and labor without disrupting the indigenous way of life. None of this would be possible without the 2,500 or so volunteers who work with the villagers as a collective, as members of the same team. Today, resettling the Indus encompasses 40 or 50 villages in the southern Punjab, Sindh, and South Waziristan. The conversation began with my asking this young urban architect how he knew what to do. But how did you know where to begin? I asked.
So when the floods came, you were ready, in a sense.
I think so. I think we knew exactly what we had to do, because there were two things that were happening. We knew how to plan. I mean, that's the expertise that we know of. We know how to plan. So literally, the first meeting happened the day after this, the first council meeting that we had with professors and youngsters and colleagues and people that were not architects, but we had huge maps of Pakistan, huge maps. I mean, 30, 40 sheets, they were large. And on top of those, we started drawing architectural plans. You know, I mean, that was the first day.
And so what kind of things were you doing that first day?
Macro and micro scale planning. Because we have to look at it in two different segments. Number one, what is happening on ground? And number two, what is the implication to the entire region about it?
You knew what to expect visually, physically?
Yes, we did. Because during the relief efforts, when we couldn't build, when the flood water was there, I mean, you can't physically do anything. Right. You can't even make the brick. But during that time, we knew that we had a greater exercise to do than building. It was to figure out how to build and what to build. So all that planning, it was about 3 months of just rigor. A lot of trucks were leaving out of Lahore. So with these student organizations, you know, a few of us architects who, you know, eventually got into resettling the Indus, we approached the team as resettling the Indus. I mean, even though there were a few of us, but we knew what we were doing. We had to go there and say, listen, you guys are going anyway. Let us just hitch along with you. We'll bring our equipment, we'll bring our team, our survey forms, and we'll get down to figuring out who the local district authority is, what has happened on site, we'll photograph it, we'll document it. So it gave us something to go and figure out what is wrong. There's no understanding of the real problem on site, but solutions are starting, I mean, getting drafted now.
So how did you reverse that?
Instead of starting to sketch, we saved our energy and got on a bus. And we just went. I mean, wherever food and medication is going, you know some other team has done their recce. If they didn't, you'll find out on site. Wherever you go, you find water. mean, Muzaffargarh became a district which was mostly devastated because all the five rivers hit here. And we also knew that this was something that was close to Lahore and something that we can continuously go and make an example out of at least one brick, one mason, one building, one village, and replicate it throughout that area. And that has, mashallah, happened.
So do you remember the first house that you built?
Of course. And it wasn't a house. And that's also one of the very important rules. It doesn't make an impact in the village if you make one or 10 houses or 100 houses, because the end result will be benefiting one family or eight members. What you need to do is go and start mobilizing the team or mobilizing the people of the village to become a team. Now, in that, the selection of the first building is very important. So we don't choose a home. It's always a civic building, something that the entire village will share at the end. So they know that the first brick that is put in there is their contribution. So it brings unity to the entire project.
So what was the first?
The dispensary.
Building? Dispensary.
Yeah, it was a dispensary, and it took 7 weeks. The reason why it took 7 weeks, because I broke it down into seven stages of architecture. So when the foundations were dug, I had them stop. When the foundations were filled, I had them stop. When the walls were built, and it took longer. It cost me more. It cost me 1,20,000 to build the first dispensary.
What is that in dollars?
$1,200.
So you stopped at each stage? I'm not.
Why I did that is because I needed to know how they finished the stage, and I also needed to know if there needs to be amendments or corrections, because it was the first project that not only was visual proof for the villagers that we're serious about work, but it also gave us a chance to see from one building all the teething problems. Like financially, how long does it take? How much does it take? How many masons does it need? How much material will it require? Where will the material come from? What's the transport? There's so many things to get one building built, but all of that gets done in first building. Now, we still continue working in the villages this way, that we go there and choose a building, and we make sure that this process is a lengthy one, the first building, which is to make sure that the villagers and you know their capacity, you know what they're capable of, and they know what you're expecting.
But what you're saying is that, and this may not be clear to people, is that the villagers were doing the building.
Oh,
it's
yes.
It's not as if you were bringing in, importing workers from somewhere.
No, not at all. See, that's the reason. The mobilization of the village happens through them working to build this first building. All the masons and anyone who's working in resettling the Indus has from the local community. It has to be from the village. The villagers, their participation in building this first structure allows them to learn exactly the techniques that are necessary to improve the building. Now, it's very important because there's a reason why a lot of these buildings fell. I mean, there's a structural fault in them which allows them to be very flimsy in times of floods or heavy rains or these natural disasters. Now, heavy roofings and lighter foundations was a typical convention to build in rural areas in Pakistan. And these villagers, then in building the first structure or the dispensary that we made, they learned these different stages of architecture or stages of the building. So the next building doesn't take that long because they're working on it. And
so one of the things was that the foundations were weak because
they didn't use clay bricks. They used mud bricks. So to lighter the roof, we use bamboo or lighter woods. It would be an equal distribution.
Okay. So now, what I'd like to do is get some idea of the scope of your work to date. It's been 2.5 years since the floods happened, the first floods. You know, I know this number, 1.2 million homes.
Yeah.
How many houses in the area that you're concerned with, how many houses fell? And then in 2012, how many of those had you rebuilt?
When we came into the village and started distributing the medication and the food, the area that we chose to, you know, focus on to was about, I'd say 30, 40 villages. Mm-hmm. And in that population, about, I'd say 15, 18,000, something around that. I mean, there are a few villages that are quite large. I mean, Basti Pitafi and Basti Obhechar, they would have about a population of 2,500, 2,200. Mm-hmm. But then there are others that are smaller pockets of 50 homes or 60 homes. Just these 40, 50 villages, only about 15-20% was still standing. Mm. And these were mosques and these were government schools, but majority of the houses were flattened. I mean, the only thing left standing are the people, the families who have not migrated, and now everything is to ground and it's all mud. I mean, it makes you realize, I mean, the material you're made of, and they're still standing. I think the people who have resettled themselves in these 40, 50 villages, because now you see the over 700 some houses are, you know, mashallah, resettled, and schools are operated, and people who are from the villages, or even those who have come back to the villages, are now teaching in the same schools. They're trained once by other organizations, but then they replicate their training to other people in the village. Prior to the floods, there were no schools, and there were no facilities for or playgrounds or things that children need. And I think they've been overlooked because they're not a part of these 5-6 metropolitan cities that Pakistan has been concerned for the past 60 years.
So when the floods came, it was an opportunity to restructure the society in a sense?
Well, it was an opportunity to start remaking what began in 1947, to begin remaking Pakistan. Because I think 60 years have been lost. I mean, as an architect and as a Pakistani, I'm speaking. 60 years put into 5-6 cities to grow them into a certain way to make it a difference from the 60-70% that lives without any resources. But yet everything that we base ourselves on, the agricultural society that we are, is all from there.
From the 60%.
I mean, from the 60% that is not bothered about. So I think it's that. I think it is not the fault of the villager who didn't know about the weight of that heavy timber. It's the fault of those who knew and didn't bother about those who didn't.
So what is resettling the Indus? What is it other than rebuilding the houses that have fallen and making a school here and there? I mean, it's a big question, so I'm asking it in that way. What is it that this whole project is about? The idea of resettling the Indus is actually a very unfamiliar concept to a lot of the people who are listening to this program.
It's not confined, I can tell you that, and I'll elaborate. When we began this process, we weren't sure what it was, an NGO or a foundation, or we were helping or learning or teaching. We didn't have that concept in our mind that we will go there and we will do this and there will be better people. I mean, it wasn't that. I mean, today, anyone you see in my team, you find that they have resettled themselves. And resettling, if you ask me personally, has a lot to do with humanity, how to be a human being. And I think these things are discourses that are greater than the Indus. They're global, universal. I mean, if there's life on Mars, Mars will have this discourse. Because, I mean, humanity is lost. The idea of being a humane being is just completely, you know, alien today, whether you're in the U.S., whether you're in Timbuktu or Pakistan or Lahore, you name it, or in the villages. I don't think it was the house. I think the houses were the excuse for us to get into a process in which it's not just what you do for yourself. Now that it's 2 years prior, 2.5 years prior, I see that we take the same journey, the same road, same 7.5 hours that way, 7.5 hours, 15 hours
driving,
every...
Driving to and from the village.
Driving to and from the village. This is average. I mean, when I go to Waziristan, it's 18 hours. But that travel distance, that hours, those time, it has never been a concern. Because right after Friday, you know, 5 o'clock, the team leaves, and Monday morning at 4 o'clock we come back, and
leaving the city, full-time job.
That's the difficulty, because I mean, Monday to Friday, I mean, that's a rule in RT Indus. If you're not a full-time student or not a full-time employee, you cannot resettle the Indus with us. I'm sorry.
What's the thinking there?
We don't want empty minds here. I mean, there's a mentality, you know, you're not doing anything, join an NGO. Well, this is not an NGO. This is a consultancy. We're architects for the villagers, and it is very important and serious to us, because every house is designed particularly to how the villager wants it. Why? Because he's the user and the builder. He's learning and getting trained while he's practicing architecture with us. So, I mean, through the building, through the process of it, through the dialogues and laughter and jokes and, you know, sadness, all of it concludes into the resettling of that place, that land. We find that that land could have been done in any way, but the process is what makes it resettling the Indus. I think an architect is a thinker. He has to solve problems. And his job is not to get a lot of jobs. His job is to make sure that a lot of people around him have jobs. He has to compose that building. That building is a means to a lot of people's income, and it has to make an impact in society. Well, I think we'll end up making the greatest building ever. We'll rebuild our nation.
Heather Ibrahim, architect and founder of Resettling the Indus, was talking to me in Lahore, Pakistan, in March 2013. This is Tidings from Hazel Khan on WPKN.
So talk about the whole idea of financial independence, sustainability, all of these things in order to rebuild. You didn't even have the bricks.
Yeah.
You had mud, but you didn't have bricks from there. So now I know that you're selling bricks.
And it's a great story. Technically, we began the first enterprise before the first building was built, and that was the mud brick industry. At the time of the floods, the greatest commodity was brick, and everybody wanted it. And the larger kilns that you find all over, they know this. So the cost would rise, and the demand would be more, the supply would be less.
And you'd have to transport
it too. And the monopoly. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, knowing that, every other aspect of the project is there. The masons are there, they're ready to train. The architects are there to plan. The mobilization is there, everything.
And the materials.
Materials are there, except the most important material, which is the brick. That was the stoppage. I mean, we didn't have brick, and we were buying from the other bhattas. And usually, a typical brick maker makes 900 bricks per day. And I mean, long story short, it would take us about one mason would take 1 month to build the bricks we need for the house. I mean, 28,000 bricks. One mason builds about 1,000 a day, almost a month. And we knew we wouldn't be able to do that. So we started the enterprise in the village. We went to the village and saw one farm was not doing well. The crop wasn't doing so well, so we gave him full collateral and said, can we borrow the land? I mean, that's the beauty of this process, that we don't have to make one stationary factory, huge, you know, smokestacks coming out, disturbing the environment. It doesn't have to happen that way. It's very sustainable and very environmentally friendly. And that's how we move from, you know, site to site. Wherever we need the brick, wherever the larger quantum of work is happening, we set up a small mud brick enterprise there. And the villagers automatically have work in their homes. I mean, they don't have to leave their village. Inside their village is the largest industry, which is now 2.5 years later, and it's expanded that way. We sell for a lot more than we make it. That's how we resettle.
So who gets the money?
The villager.
The villager or the village?
We can't have, you know, one person dictating everyone else's decisions. So the enterprises are owned by the villagers.
So the worker owns the means to production.
Well, of course. And so the money comes into a complete cycle where the production of brick is 55 pesos per brick. The sale of brick is 1 rupee 25 pesos, $550 to make 100,000 brick. And that's usually the sale quantum. So a brick kiln comes to me and says, I want 100,000 brick. To make that, I spent $550. And the sale of it is at $1,250. So I make or $750 from the sale of 100,000 bricks.
So when you say I make...
Meaning resettling the Indus. I mean, I, the organization, the enterprise itself. I mean, we all represent each other. I mean, in this, we usually get loose with the I term.
But you don't make the money yourself. You don't pocket any of the money.
Oh, well, I mean, you know, the interesting way of looking at it is, even if, God forbid, I did, I mean, I am owned by resettling the Indus. My job here today is to make sure that the idea does not stop. Since you brought it up, the team that is expanded is based entirely 100% volunteer. They do, and it's very organic. Nobody ever questions why we don't get paid, because it doesn't make sense. We all are either full-time employees or full-time students, or like myself and others, we own our own, you know, separate system as well, that we don't have to rely on resettling the Indus to make money. So everyone who's doing it knows that philosophy. And the result of knowing that you've been able to take part in building the greater, you know, Indus Valley civilization is beyond a buck.
Is there a bank account?
To
be crude, but
it's very important. It's very technical, because after all, money has to be moved from one hand to the other, mm-hmm. and it has to be documented and be accounted for. So there's a proper accounting team. We become an example to other professionals to use their expertise to help resettle the Indus. So, I mean, for me, I would draw buildings and I would direct how to get it done. But for an accountant who is excited about, I mean, taking a part in it, he's like, Heather Bhai, how can I help? I mean, I know how to deal with numbers. And as an economist, he's like, you know, listen, I know how to write this report. I mean, I can get this. Let me join you. And so these team of, you know, eclectic professionals have joined together. And before graduating, they're getting stuff done, you know, significantly on ground. I mean, and they know that. The three regions we're working in, Sindh, Khyber, Punjab, have their separate accounts. But there's a main resettling the Indus account with the SWIFT code and, you know, ways of, you know, sending money from international locations also. Mm-hmm. And all of it gets updated so quickly every week. People know nothing slows us down. The money that gets here gets quickly put into the building, and that building is documented and put onto Facebook, into a report or into a certain compilation to send back to the donor in a matter of a week. Mm-hmm. And they see results and they're amazed. And I mean, we want to show this credibility of our country because, I mean, that's lacking here.
But also, it's not just the BRICS, right? Could you just talk briefly about the other revenue streams or the other maybe enterprises?
Sure. There are many cottage industries. I mean, these small social enterprises ran by the people, for the people, those type of things. But we also wanted to see how we can bring a great news of the village to the cities. And organic produces are all that the villagers have.
So the villages have become networked.
Yes. Because you have to look at it from a villager's point of view. The first village being built or the first building being built is news to all the surrounding villages. We don't have to go from village to village anymore, or even the next village, to go and start introducing the idea, because they would come to help because they want work. I mean, the most important thing to a villager is that he remains working. Now here, instead of having a daily day-to-day job, now he has a monthly salary. I think we have to be a bit philosophical. Someone asked me, you're doing all this and you're telling me about 60 things that you haven't done but you're planning to do, but you're also telling me that you don't have any money. So what is this deal? What's going on? What is your financial security? My financial security, or my security that the work will continue, is based entirely on the fact that I don't do someone wrong. I make sure I do someone right. And I make sure that as a person, I've contributed to something that benefits someone other than me. And it could be a plant or or an animal. It doesn't matter. I didn't think that before. When we know that it has been too long that the villager is waiting for his money and we don't have donations raised, and we know something is up, and that something cannot be the process going wrong, that something may be attached a lot to our consciousness. It may seem very spiritual, but that's actually what it is. The process itself allows you to see that you have no other being to rely on but your creator. And I mean, I say this word creator in terms of, we are making something, yet by making it, we're being made. I mean, that relation, in terms of work, I mean, it's entirely work, you see? That's the worship, that's the relation. We may be making that house, or we may be on that journey, but I mean, there's a journey being made by us going on that journey. You see, I mean, that's the philosophical part about it, that you can't really tell if you were the composer or the actor. You thought you were the one deciding that, this is the journey that I'm going to take, but that's what you thought. It may be entirely something, beyond that. And that's why I know that this journey has no end. It doesn't. I mean, all my life I've worked on projects. And before going to my university, I worked on architectural projects. But all of those projects had some start and some end. The success is not to have a deadline. It is something that has to continue. The villages that began resettling, some may think when the houses get built, it's resettled. But I was thinking about it more. It is only then when the life starts again. And the success would be when our next generations want to know what Pakistan is. We don't have to take them to Minar-e-Pakistan and Badshahi Masjid and other museums and Mohatta Palace. We can take them to any part of the country and stop our car anywhere and open the doors and say, this is Pakistan. And that's what I hope. And in 60 years, you and I will both walk that Indus resettled, inshallah.
So how will Pakistan be different when the Indus is resettled? You're a Pakistani who wants to basically remake Pakistan.
Yeah. By remaking it, the buildings would be the reflection of the people. It is not about making skyscrapers to make this country look modern or progressive. It's that the buildings must reflect the society that it is serving. That relation between the building and the people need to be very apparent, need to be very, very visible. I see a Pakistan that resembles the beautiful hearts that are here. The common man of this country is outstanding. You find that the most hardworking people that you come across are in the villagers, and the most honest and sincere people. it's not to take anything away from other societies, it's just that it's more apparent there. It has a lot to do with where they live, how they live. I mean, in which context and material they live. I mean, if you wake up in mud and you sleep in mud, you may be a bit down to earth. I don't know. Those are my, personal, findings in the Indus.
I just want to ask you, though, I mean, we've talked about the mud all the time, but in fact, you've also been resettling Waziristan, right?
Mm.
Southern.
Yeah,
Southern Waziristan.
And also Sindh.
But the Waziristan story is slightly different because it was not a natural disaster.
Mm.
I mean, your work is not involved in the area where the drones have destroyed villages.
These are those villages. This was during the war, Afghan war, 9 years ago, 9 years ago. North Waziristan is where the drones, the drone parts in North Waziristan. Here, I mean, it was bombardment and...
But there the houses are more built of stone than of mud.
Yeah, they were.
Is anything different about any of that, or anything that you said doesn't apply there or applies differently?
When Waziristan came as a project to us, we knew that the climate and the culture would be different. But we were excited to see if the process would replicate, and it did. And that's the success of it, because you find that, in Sindh and Waziristan and in Swat right now also, this process is replicating exactly how it was in Punjab. I mean, where they were making bricks, now they're carving stone. But in order to shape and carve the stone for the houses, I mean, it has to be brought from a certain, location to a certain, point. And, I mean, to do that, the enterprises become.
They're going to actually be selling stone?
They are selling stone. I mean, right now we are currently selling stone. I mean, they're making money.
What is the material?
It's mud and straw, and bamboo is very, common there.
But so again, you say the model, basically.
The model is the same. The model is based on a social movement. People are mobilized entirely, the social community, and they automatically know where they stand and where they have their expertise or resources.
So is that what resettling the Indus is? It's a social movement? You don't want to be pinned down, maybe, but people must have asked you, what is it? Is it you're obviously not an NGO, you're not a politician. I mean, it may not matter, but...
Well, if it has to be categorized, then why stop at a movement? In history... The only thing that is that you find making an impact is when we revolt from the way we were before. If anything, this is the only revolution. You don't need to hold up banners and get abusive or offensive or defensive or throw tantrums to have a revolution. I mean, it could start as slow and small as the root of the grass. And here, I mean, what else is it? I mean, if it started with two people talking on the top of a roof, and right now, I mean, in three regions and over 2,500 people volunteering around this entire country, and in the matter of 2 years, what I see is the same dream being dreamt all across the Indus. And imagine that in the next, decades.
The same dream for the villagers and the volunteers.
And the volunteers. And it's no longer, a barrier between his community, my community, his way of life, my way of life.
Town and village.
Yeah, town or village. It crosses that. And I think it was necessary, and it came in the exact time that it did. I mean, it is the only time that we have. I mean, we cannot let this go. That's the reason why, I mean, we're very adamant that this idea remains. It continues. It maintains its momentum. It's growing so fast. I mean, it's hard for us to catch what we started. It's an ideology that anybody around the globe who is adamant about justice, about education, about healthcare, about the respect of the common man, about unity, honesty, brotherhood, anything that matters to a human being, and I pray that it becomes an example for the globe. We're the most deprived country, if you look at it. I mean, we're the black sheep of the globe. And imagine having an example in the next decade of people just getting up and doing it.
You heard Heather Ibrahim, architect and founder of Resettling the Indus, talking about his team's work in Pakistan's South Punjab region after the floods of 2010 and 2012. More information is on Facebook/RTIndus. Tidings from Hazel Khan is heard on the second Wednesday each month. All Tidings podcasts are posted on hazelkhan.com. Tidings is produced by Tony Ernst.